The following is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Andrew Longhurst.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us. On the program today, we'll be hosting an all-candidates debate in studio with the candidates for VP External, VP Admin, and VP Finance for the 2010 AMS elections. Also in campus news, we'll be speaking to Tricia Tunisia from Medicine Sans Frontières, UBC Student Club, about the recent fundraising efforts here on the UBC campus. We'll also have an interview with Ray Rogers, the director of the Global Campaign to Stop Killer Coke, about the Coca-Cola case film that will be screened on the UBC campus as part of the Social Justice Center's third annual Rethinking the Olympics conference. We'll have all this plus your weekday weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. But first, we're happy to have our friends from the UBC in studio. I have Paul Bucci and Justin McRoy with me for this week's headlines. Here they are.
Good evening. I'm Justin McRoy here with Paul Bucci, and here are today's front page stories. Poverty is not a crime, and resist police control were the rallying cries of over 100 anti-Olympic protesters last Friday. The demonstration was against an alleged Olympic security crackdown, which protesters claim has resulted in the harassment of certain parties by the police. The protest disrupted traffic, but no arrests were reported.
The grand reopening of the Museum of Anthropology brought thousands of visitors to UBC last week. $55 million were spent renovating and expanding the museum. However, the focus was on how the museum interacts with the objects in its collection. The museum's curator, Karen Dufek, said, "In museums, an object can be easily removed from society. It is stuck in a case. It is named something that might be totally wrong, and it is numbered. To try to break down this wall and reconnect the objects back to the people they came from is the most important thing."
Earth and Ocean Sciences professor Lee Grote recently had a new species of phosphate mineral named after him. A team led by researchers from the University of Manitoba published details of the new finding in the latest issue of the Canadian Mineralogist. Head investigator Frank Hawthorne named the new mineral grotite in honor of Professor Grote's large research contribution to pegmatite mineralogy. "I was surprised and honored," said Grote. "When Hawthorne approached me in Quebec City to ask my permission to name a mineral after me, I was stunned," he said in UBC reports.
UBC Okanagan opened its first Aboriginal Student Center last Friday. Director of Aboriginalization Lyle Mueller says the center will give its will give First Nations students a place to use the computer, study, and relax, even socialize, reported Kelowna AM 1150. Mueller says there are approximately 230 Aboriginal students at UBCO who are enrolled in a variety of the university's programs. $600,000 was funded by the province towards the center's completion, as the government hopes it will lead to an increase in Aboriginal enrollment.
Former UBC employee Jen Ride has started a Haiti fundraiser that is linked to the UBC Winter Sports Center ticket sales. Ride, who worked for UBC Athletics, has gone to aid to Haiti three times since the earthquake hit, and has just recently tagged him with UBC Athletics to raise funds for Danita's Children, an organization that supports the Hope for Haiti's Children's Center Orphanage. Within the next month, $5 of all $10 regular home games for hockey, volleyball, and basketball will be given to aid in Haiti. Donations will feed 100 newly orphaned children brought to the center, which is located in a relatively unaffected part of Haiti, near the Dominican Republic border.
For the UBC Front Page News and Justin McRoy, this is Paul Bucci.
And thank you to the UBC, and thanks especially to Paul and Justin for that coverage. In local and national news, thousands of Canadians took part in anti-prorogation rallies across the country, from Vancouver to Ottawa to St. John's and even to London, England. Frustrated and angry Canadians protested Prime Minister Stephen Harper's suspension of Parliament. Without the prorogation, MPs would be returning to Ottawa today to resume parliamentary duties. In Vancouver, an estimated 1,000 turned out this past Saturday for the rally at the Vancouver Art Gallery and the march that followed to Victory Square. The March in Vancouver was one of 50 events across the country in response to the prorogation of Parliament. News 101 reporter Carrie Baptist was at the rally and joins us on the line. Thanks for being with us, Carrie.
Hi, Andrew.
So can you give us a little idea of what the rally was like and the march that followed?
Sure. A minor correction. I spoke to a police officer on the scene, and he said that the police estimate was more like 1,500 people at the rally. And it was a very exciting time. A lot of times you hear people characterize political protests as just being a usual, you know, gang of liberal suspects. And happily, this protest, it didn't follow that protest stereotype. There were a whole variety of people from all sides of the political spectrum. A point that was noted by both organizers and just you could see for yourself as observing the crowd. And it was a lively, peaceful event.
And so you took part in the march that followed. Did people stay part of the rally and continue on for that march?
Yes, actually, the major rally took place at Victory Square at the end, and there was a slate of speakers, a man who characterized himself as a grumpy conservative, a woman from Fair Vote Canada who was pushing for electoral reform, a lawyer from the BC Civil Liberties Association, among others, and each had their own sort of political perspective, but they all emphasized the point that it was about democracy, that this wasn't, regardless of whether you support Stephen Harper or not, from their perspective, it's not acceptable to just have democracy put on hold. And all the speakers pointed out how important the current the slate of bills was that the conservative government has just quashed.
Right.
Actually, to me, the most interesting point, and it was brought up a lot, was the role of Canada in torture in Afghanistan. And this wasn't something that I was personally super aware about, super aware of. But apparently, and it was actually the conservative speaker who brought this up, Canada knew that it was delivering detainees in Afghanistan to prisons run by the Afghan government that were engaging in torture. And this was an issue that was set to be discussed during the upcoming session of Parliament, which has now been obviously prorogued. And so the issue is sort of, it's perceived that the conservative government is trying to just push this issue under the bed, so to speak.
Before we let you go, just over a year ago, there was quite a bit of outrage over the first prorogation. Do you feel that the mood was different at all at this a year later, this rally against the prorogation?
I'm not sure that Harper has ever prorogued before. I think Liberal prime ministers have done it in the past, but
he prorogued right after, right before there was talk of the coalition to avoid that question, right?
So yeah,
Do you think there was a different feeling, like an increased level of outrage from?
Certainly, people are really angry, and they definitely emphasize the fact that when you have a minority government, it's maybe less fair, or it's an easier thing to attack when you prorogue. Some people called for an amendment to be made in Parliament, so the saying in the future that prime ministers can't prorogue without a 50% vote or something. I think the fact that it's a minority government was contentious for a lot of people.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Carrie, for bringing us that coverage from the rally and the march.
Thank you.
Take care. Thanks to Carrie Baptist, our own News 101 reporter. We're going to take a quick break, but you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Maybe a song from a film or a tune from TV. Radio Free GAC brings you sounds of the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future and the forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down.
Radio Free Gap. Monday evening, 7:30 till 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
As Canadians have personally donated nearly $67 million to relief efforts in Haiti, the UBC campus has also been active in fundraising efforts for the country. On Friday, the 22nd of January, students, staff, and faculty put on an event at the Frederick Wood Theater to raise money for the relief efforts. Speakers included Alan Sens, chair of the International Relations Program, representatives for Haiti Solidarity for BC, UBC President Stephen Toop, and senior staff from MSF. Trisha of the MSF UBC Student Club joins us live in studio to discuss the on-campus fundraising efforts and the organization's relief work in Haiti. Trisha, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
So can you tell us a little bit about the event that happened last week?
Yeah, so the event was actually a joint collaboration between a lot of student groups on campus and concerned students who weren't even part of AMS sort of clubs, and they just decided they wanted to do something. The Global Lounge, newly opened at Marine Drive, was a great avenue, facilitated sort of meetings for students, and a bunch of groups just came together and decided that we wanted to do a big event, got support from the UBC administration, and before you know it, it was Friday, and it went really well. So
there were speakers and was there music as well?
Yeah, there were two performances. There was a musical sort of encore at the last bit, and that was really good. And there was also a poetry slam by Regina, so that went really well.
Great. And so it was a pretty full theater as well?
It was totally packed, and we raised definitely over $4,000.
So, wow, that's great. Yeah. So what other events are planned? Are you personally planning, or do you know that are being planned on campus in response?
So the Triple H, Help Here Haiti, is a coalition of a lot of students, and so we're sort of all involved in planning long-term events that will help Haiti not only for emergency relief but also develop. And the most sort of important one coming up is on Tuesday. Every Tuesday starting tomorrow, the 26th, there will be documentary series about Haiti and about its social, cultural, and historical context. We're also planning an end-of-the-term gala dinner and possibly a talk about the ethical sort of implications of volunteering in Haiti.
Great. Is there anything additionally that our listeners should be aware of?
So this time we did donate all our proceeds to MSF, but Triple H is a very sort of neutral group, so we will be donating proceeds to other organizations as well. And we encourage all students to get involved and help us make this a big success like Friday.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us in studio, Trisha. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're going to take a quick break for a public service announcement, but we'll be right back with an interview from the director of the global campaign to stop Killer Coke.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, Slickety Jim's Chat and Chew, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, The Whip Gallery Restaurant, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member. Get a free friends card and feel the love.
In more campus news, the Social Justice Center is hosting their third annual Rethinking the Olympics from the 26th to the 28th of January. On the 28th of January, the Social Justice Center will be screening the Coca-Cola case film, which spotlights the labor practices of the Olympic sponsor. We now go to News 101 reporter Kate Hughes, who interviewed Ray Rogers, the director of the Stop Killer Coke campaign.
Thanks, Andrew. This is a report on the Killer Coke campaign, a campaign running to highlight the human rights abuses of the Coca-Cola company. This week on campus, the Social Justice Centre are showing the Coca-Cola case film in their Rethinking the Olympics conference. This film is being shown in Cinema Politica theatres across Canada, and the Coca-Cola company have tried to prevent this film from being shown by sending a threatening letter to Cinema Politica. I spoke to Ed Dagon, a member of the Social Justice Centre, as well as Ray Rogers, the director of the Killercoat campaign, to find out more.
Okay, I'm in the studio now with Ed Dagon from the Social Justice Centre here at UBC. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Kate.
So, firstly, could you just tell us a bit about the Social Justice Centre and what you guys are all about?
Yeah, sure. The Social Justice Centre is an AMS resource group. So we're actually funded by the AMS, but we're an autonomous group within the resource groups. The SJC is one of the sort of rallying points on campus for political radicals, I guess you would say.
Yeah. And at the moment, I hear that you're organising this Rethinking the Olympics. Can you just tell us a bit about that? What's going on and around campus?
Sure, that's correct. We're the SJC is one of the kind of the de facto representative of the 2010 Welcoming Committee, mm-hmm. which is a group of activist organizations in Vancouver, the BC area, that are organizing in resistance to the Olympics. And yesterday we hosted David Zirin, who's a radical sports writer, who spoke about politics and sports. And that's kind of leading up to next week's conference, Rethinking the Olympics, which is a series of workshops and panels and a party that we're putting together to try to broaden the dialogue on campus, which for the most part UBC has uncritically accepted everything Olympics.
In particular, we're really interested in the Coca-Cola case film that I think you're showing on January the 28th at the Norm Theatre. Why do you think that this is important to show in terms of the Olympics and Coke being the official sponsor?
Well, yeah, Coca-Cola is one of the official corporate sponsors of the Olympics, among many others, which are also, you know, well-known violators of human rights, arms manufacturers, big pharmaceuticals, things like that. The SJC this year is in charge of Cinema Politica. We had a few films to choose from for that particular slot. We chose the Coke film because they are an Olympic sponsor, and it coincided, that Thursday coincided with the Rethinking the Olympics conference. The Killer Coke case is something that's really well known amongst in activist circles, and in fact, years ago, it was the main campaign of the Social Justice Center here at UBC a few years ago. So it was kind of a no-brainer to pick the Coca-Cola case for us, since it just became available. It's a new film. Mm-hmm. And we want to highlight the human rights abuses that Coke has perpetrated in South America, particularly where, you know, it's well known that Coca-Cola has engaged in union-busting practices to the extreme, where they're actually hiring paramilitary goons to kill, to assassinate union labor organizers and to terrorize their families and the communities in which they're trying to build a coalition of workers to unionize workers to improve conditions, human rights conditions down there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's interesting. What kind of benefit do you think then Coke will receive from being an official sponsor, like compared to, say, like Pepsi or something in Vancouver?
Well, you're already seeing all over town the sort of and on the products themselves, the use of the Olympics logo associated with Coca-Cola, right in their advertisements, on their products and so forth. And like I say, UBC has uncritically accepted the Olympics as sort of a universally good thing, a good event. And by and large, society also accepts the Olympics in such a way, as if sport itself, as if the Olympics are merely about sports, and that sports are apolitical, and that the Olympic Games is sort of non-capitalist, non-partisan, non-political kind of event, which, highlights fairness, fair play, excellence, discipline, all of these virtues. And, you know, clearly Coca-Cola wants to, would much rather, from a marketing standpoint, and they're ruthless marketers, from a marketing standpoint, they want to associate themselves with all things virtuous, especially Olympic sports at this time, yeah. as opposed to, you know, what is really happening in the production of their products.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. That's really interesting. And good luck with your rethinking the Olympics at UBC.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So I'm just on the line now with Ray Rogers, and he's the director of the Coca-Cola case film. It's being shown in the Norm Theatre on campus this week by the Social Justice Centre in their conference for rethinking the Olympics. So, hi, Ray. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Hey, Kate, let me make one little correction. I'm actually the director of the worldwide campaign to stop Killer Cokes. The director of the film is a fellow by the name of Herman Gutierrez, and the co-producer along with him is Carmen Garcia.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much, Ray. So could you just give us a bit of a general context of what the film is about and why you've made it, and just a bit about the film?
Well, what the film does is it focuses on one key area, which are the serious human rights abuses by Coca-Cola bottlers in Colombia. Mm-hmm. Coca-Cola is a virulently anti-union company, and it claims that any allegations that its bottlers in Colombia are involved in the systematic intimidation, kidnapping, torture, and murder of union leaders are false. Yet the company has opposed every effort at any kind of independent investigation into these allegations. And this is what the film, The Coca-Cola Case, focuses on, is what is happening at Coca-Cola bottling plants in Colombia. The lawsuits that make these allegations and the campaign to stop Killer Coke, which has gotten Coke kicked out of about 52 colleges and universities so far.
So how do you feel about Coke's attempts to censor the film? I mean, the threatening letters, does this just highlight their guilt, really demonstrate their guilt?
Well, it's a company that has used all kinds of bullying and intimidation tactics, whether it be against their workers trying to unionize or people fighting against them on the environmental concerns, or in this case, beginning showing the truth in a film, the Coca-Cola case. For free democratic labor unions are critical to improve wages and working conditions for all wages and for democracies to flourish. In Colombia, for workers in Colombia, a strong union can also mean the difference between life and death. And this film focuses on this. Mm-hmm. When Coca-Cola goes out to try to censor and suppress this film, it's just another effort by them to suppress the truth getting out. This is a company that time and time again has refused to go head-to-head with me in any kind of a debate. Whenever any campus has tried to set up a debate between Coca-Cola representatives and myself, company has either pulled out or refused to do so. And I have an open invitation that Coca-Cola can send anybody, public relations expert, their lawyers, any executives. I'd be happy to go head-to-head with them because it's a company that can't deal with the truth or with the facts.
Yeah, definitely. So how about the success of the film so far? I mean, it was shown, I think the first viewing was the 18th of January. How did that go?
Well, at Concordia, they'd only had one other, I understand, sellout, not a sellout, but where the theater was full. Mm-hmm. I think that was for the film The Corporation. They had actually turned 50 people away. We broke the record. There were 700 people that filled the theater, and they had to turn 200 people away.
Whoa. Wow. So it's popular. And how about can you just comment on the success of the Killer Coke campaign in general?
Well, the campaign itself has been very effective, and one of the reasons, when you look into the film, you'll see that there are efforts by Coca-Cola to try to resolve or to settle the legal cases. What they were really concerned about was the impact that the campaign was having. And although the film doesn't show it, the key thing with any kind of a settlement was that we would have to end our campaign, which we were willing to do if the company was really resolving the situation and the integrity of the union was going to be protected and the safety and rights of the workers and the union leaders would be protected. What this company did and what it comes out in the film is they were trying to throw a lot of money at trying to resolve the situation, but at the same time were demanding, one, a complete gag order on me for the rest of my life, a complete gag order on the union leaders for the rest of their life, and that any union leader that was involved in the lawsuit would have to resign from and could never work for Coca-Cola again.
So we spoke today to a member of the Social Justice Center here at, on campus called Ed Dugon, and he was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus. And obviously, for them, they're doing a conference called Rethinking the Olympics. So they felt that it was definitely necessary to include in this, obviously, because Coke is an official sponsor of the Olympics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring that up, and that's why I really excited about doing this interview with you. Is the Olympics being out there in Vancouver. Obviously, Coca-Cola is trying to prevent anything that would challenge an image or reputation that they don't deserve. Mm-hmm. This is a company that has spends about $3 billion a year to create an image or reputation or reality that masks the ugly reality that this company is. This company is not a giver, it is an exploiter. This is a company that is guilty of widespread, on a worldwide scale, guilty of massive labor, human rights, and environmental abuses. This film, the Coca-Cola case, focuses on the human rights abuses and the systematic intimidation, kidnapping, torture, and murder of union leaders in efforts to crush their union, Sinaltrinol, in Colombia. But if we want to talk about other issues that Coke is involved in 2004, Human Rights Watch did a report reporting that Coca-Cola was benefiting from hazardous child labor in the sugarcane fields of El Salvador. Mm-hmm. That the sugarcane that these kids were cutting was used by the sugar suppliers for Coca-Cola to produce sugar. That was in 2004. In 2007, there was a national documentary that aired throughout the UK, and footage that was taken in 2007 showed massive number of children working still in these sugarcane fields, harvesting the sugarcane that goes to Coca-Cola sugar suppliers. On many, many fronts, it's a company that is very dirty. It's certainly the clean image that it tries to create is not something they deserve.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, their advertisements are going to be all over Vancouver now with the up-and-coming Olympics. So,
you know, if I were to, try to sum up just maybe a few sentences, a message that I have, and I have challenged Coke, and you'll see, and basically some of this you'll see repeated in a film or something, I've said something like it, but number one, to sum up the world of Coca-Cola, the world of Coca-Cola is a world full of lies, deception, immorality, corruption, and widespread labor, human rights, and environmental abuses. And when people think of the Coca-Cola company, they should think of a company that inflicts great hardship and despair upon many people and communities throughout the world. We're talking about China, India, Mexico, El Salvador, African countries, and elsewhere. And when people see Coca-Cola ads and beverages, they should think of crimes and misconduct on a worldwide scale so unthinkable that make all of Coke's products undrinkable.
Well, thank you very, very much for your comments, Ray. And would you just like to mention when the film is on? It's showing around Canada, isn't it, at the moment?
Yes. The Coca-Cola case right now is showing through Cinema Politica, I think, on 17 university campuses across Canada. It's also being shown in Norway, Sweden, New Zealand, and the United States through the Cinema Politica Network, which is quite an incredible organization.
Yeah.
And if people want to learn more about the sinful world of Coca-Cola, they can go to our website, killercoke.org.
Yeah.
Okay? And if they want to email us with any questions, they can email us at info@killercoke.org.
Well, thank you very much for your comments today, Ray, and thanks for your time. We really, really do appreciate it.
I'd also just like to add that we tried to get a response from the lawyers of the Coca-Cola company, but unfortunately we had no reply.
And thank you to News 101 reporter Kate Hughes for bringing us that interview. The film will be shown in the Norm Theatre in the UBC Student Union Building on the 28th of January at 12:30 p.m. It's now time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we turn now to Daniel Casanova. Hi, Daniel. How does the week look like for us?
Hey, Andrew. The next couple of days, we'll see some sun as the next low-pressure system is far off in the Pacific. Temperatures still won't drop below 3 degrees this week. The normal temperatures for this period are a high of 7 and a low of 1 degrees. We're expecting these higher than normal temperatures due to the El Niño, which is forcing the polar jet stream further north. This is resulting in colder air from the north not being able to advance south. Here's your weekday with forecast. Monday evening to the overnight, showers ending late tonight, low of 6 degrees. For Tuesday, mix of sun and cloud during the day, becoming more cloudy overnight, high of 7, low of 4. Wednesday, mix of sun and cloud again, high of 7, low of 3 degrees. For Thursday, cloudy with 40% chance of rain, high of 7, low of 4. And for Friday, periods of rain, with high of 8 degrees and a low of 5. Currently, it is 8 degrees with light rain at YVR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thank you, Daniel, for that weather coverage. It's currently 5:33, and now we bring you special coverage of the 2010 AMS president. Sorry, we bring you 2010 coverage of the AMS elections. Last Friday, News 101 hosted an in-studio all-candidate debate for AMS president and VP academic. Today, we will have two debates with the candidates for VP external and VP admin, and we'll have an interview with the candidate in the uncontested race for VP finance. First, we have the candidates for VP external in the studio: Jeremy McElroy, Stas Pavlov, and Timothy Chu. I'll first go over the format of the debate, and then we'll get started. Each candidate will be given 30 seconds for an introduction. Please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell students why they should vote for you. Following the introductions, I'll ask a question, and each candidate will have 1 minute to respond. After all candidates have responded, each candidate will be given a 30-second rebuttal to address comments made by any of the candidates. When your time has expired, we will turn off your mic. The introductions will follow in this order: Jeremy McElroy, Stas Pavlov, and Timothy Chu. Jeremy, you have 30 seconds.
All right, thanks a lot. My name is Jeremy McElroy, and I'm running for Vice President
of the Alma Mater Society at UBC Vancouver. I believe that over the past year, serving as an arts AMS counselor, I've been critical of the current executive, and even before that, I've always had a keen eye for the things that AMS has done. I believe that I'm the best candidate for the job because my platform consists of solid plans to establish a coalition of student unions across BC to better represent students in all corners of the province to the provincial government in Victoria, and to effectively lobby for student loan reform, for more accessible transit, and to represent students the way they want to be represented.
Thank you, Jeremy. Stas, you have 30 seconds.
Thanks very much. My name is Stas Pavlov, and I'm also running for the VP external position of the AMS. I believe I would differentiate myself from the other candidates is that I'm coming into this race without any previous AMS experience. I'm coming in with a clean slate, with a history of accomplishments at my faculty level. I sit on the board of directors for the Commerce Undergraduate Society, as well I'm the public relations director for Enterprise Canada, one of the large organizations on campus. My platform revolves around three things. We have the UPass, accessibility of post-secondary education, and student representation.
Thank you, Stas. Timothy, you have 30 seconds.
Hi, my name is Timothy Chu. I'm running for two reasons. One is more personal. The more personal reason is that my RESPs have run out, and I will be forced to essentially take on student loans next term. And so the financial hardship has definitely hit home and made it more prominent. In terms of education, I think we are currently at crossroads in our education system, where our tuition fees have doubled in the past 8 years, and student funding has essentially been cut by $77 million. I'm running because I want to lobby for reduced tuition fees and increased government funding.
Thank you, Timothy. Now I'll pose a question for every candidate to respond to. The order will be as follows: Jeremy, Stas, Timothy. And I also wanted to note that Aaron is not in attendance at this debate right now. And here's the question: how will you ensure that the AMS will be effective at lobbying for students, with the AMS disassociating itself from the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations, or CASA? Timothy, you're first. You have 1 minute to respond to that question.
Thank you. So the Canadian Alliance of Student Association is a federal lobbying organization, which the AMS used to be members of. Recently, AMS Council decided to vote to disaffiliate from the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations. Annually, we would spend approximately $50,000 to $70,000 with this organization in terms of membership fees. I would take this money, use it, and focus towards provincial lobbying and federal lobbying. The federal lobbying level, I would lobbied the government to create a post-secondary education act because currently there isn't a ministry of education or a minister of education on the federal government. In terms of provincial lobbying, I would take this money towards lobbying for reduced tuition fees and increased government funding. I am the only candidate that's actually spoken out on lobbying for reduced tuition fees. And that is where I stand, and that's where I use the money towards.
Thank you, Timothy. Stas, you have 1 minute.
Thanks, Tim, for explaining the background for CASA there. Now, in terms of how we can actually lobby the government and what we can do to relieve the financial hardship that students face with the cost of tuition and living in Vancouver being so high, and we need to focus on certain things such as how, that will help students to get funding for their education. So we need to focus on the student loan system, which is one of the worst in Canada at the moment. Students come out of their education, come out of the university, they have a lot of student loans. The student loan system is not very well set up right now. Students don't know how to check how much they owe, they don't know what the interest rates are, they don't know how to pay them off. As well as we need to look at other systems such as the scholarship and the bursary system. As it stands right now, I've had a very hard time finding out what scholarships or bursaries I'm eligible for as a second year student, and I think that goes the same for quite a few of the constituents that we're trying to appeal to here. So overall, I think leaving CASA leaves us with some freedom to change the way that we're lobbying. Instead of asking for a lower tuition, we can ask for a greater accessibility of funds for our post-secondary education.
Thank you, Stas. Jeremy, you have 1 minute.
All right. The reason the AMS decided to leave CASA this past year is because the policy goals of CASA were slightly different than the AMS. The AMS felt that we weren't being heard, given that we are the largest school in the organization and still weren't being able to direct that policy at the federal level. We decided to leave and take a one-year absence so that we could better focus on the issues that the AMS has taken very seriously over the past year, that being addressing tuition both for domestic and international students, as well as the student loan program, which Stas has just gone over. But in addition to that, childcare and other issues that technically fall under the provincial umbrella, sometimes in conjunction with the federal government. But we believe that the money saved from leaving CASA could be better used at the provincial level. I personally have spoken at great length about the establishment of a BC coalition of student unions, or even an annual conference of independent schools coming together to effectively and cohesively lobby the provincial government.
Thank you, Jeremy. Now, Timothy, you have 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Thanks. In terms of making our education accessible, a lot of people have been talking about that we shouldn't be lobbying for reduced tuition fees. I would beg to differ. We need to be lobbying for reduced tuition fees because tuition fees are the upfront cost and the highest barrier to education. Currently, there's over $13 billion being spent on student loans from our federal government, and students are owing $13 billion in student debt. Imagine if we took that money to reduce the cost of education and reduce tuition fees.
Thank you, Timothy. Stas, you have 30 seconds.
I'd like to address the point that Jeremy made about establishing a province-wide organization to lobby the provincial and federal governments or provincial governments. I think that as UBC, we have a lot of pull in terms of how we lobby the provincial government. We are the largest institution in the province. We amount to over $10 billion in the gross revenue for the provincial government. So for us to go out and say, let's be part of an organization, I think is not necessary at this point in time. Hence why we left the federal organization such as CASA. We can take our own stance and make sure that our students are getting the value and the money that they need.
Thank you, Stas. Jeremy, you have 30 seconds.
I don't think it's possible to have reduced tuition fees and increased government funding, given that the past few years the BC government has gone into deficit. Recognizing sort of the real situation that we're in right now, increased post-secondary funding would have to be coupled with either sort of status quo tuition fees or even increases. I don't want increased tuition. I've never advocated for that. However, I believe that the way it is right now is more than appropriate, and that student loan reform is a far more pressing matter that affects more students more significantly.
Thank you, Jeremy. So we're going to move on to the next question, our second question in this debate. Daycare is a significant issue for staff, faculty, and students. As VP External, would expanding daycare on campus be for you? And if, would campus be a priority for you? And if so, do you believe it is ethical for certain people at the university to be able to jump the queue, the daycare queue? And the order is going to be Jeremy, Stas, Timothy. Jeremy, you have 1 minute to respond to that question.
Thanks. So the two parts of the question about childcare, definitely it is something I believe very strongly about. Just recently, the Board of Governors voted to allocate $3.4 million to increase childcare spaces on campus. I think that's fantastic, but we as the AMS need to make sure that that actually comes into real spaces fast for students and for faculty and staff who have children on campus. In terms of whether it's appropriate for certain groups to jump the line, I really think that that's a gray area, and that the specific question should be whether there'd be income cutoffs, whether or not we're taking a look at specific underrepresented groups and other groups that have unique challenges on campus. So I can't really comment without sort of knowing the specifics of that, but I would definitely say that sometimes some people deserve to jump the line.
Thank you, Jeremy. Staz, you have 1 minute to respond.
So as Jeremy just stated, with the funding that we have going from the Board of Governors, we need to make sure that that funding actually gets allocated to the proper childcare systems in place, and that it's not being left out for things that are more bureaucratic and not practical. In terms of the childcare system and people who may be able to jump the line or not, I personally have a few friends at university who need to have that childcare assistance, and it's very important to them. It's something that will let them get their education, something that will let them get their degree to further be able to take care of their children. So I think with the status quo and being able to jump the line, it's going to be on a basis, I guess. And I think there will be a body that will determine that case, and whether that will be made up of students and staff and faculty, I think there should be a combination, because this is a matter that is close to a lot of students' hearts, as well as faculty and staff hearts, as you know, there's family situations at both ends of campus.
Thank you, Staz. Timothy, you have 1 minute.
I'm really glad you asked the question about childcare, Andrew. First of all, childcare has always been and always will be a priority of mine. As VP External last year, I've definitely been advocating this issue in terms of working with the Childcare Coalition in BC, in terms of working with the unions on campus. We've all created a united front to push for childcare on campus. Now, in terms of the question of whether or not it's ethical for some people to jump the line, I think the real issue is, why do we even have this lineup to begin with? If we look at the statistics, currently there are some students are waiting 2 to 3 years in order to be able to access childcare. And for some students, that means choosing between whether or not they are going to take care of their children or actually going to go to school. So I, as VP External, will definitely continue the cause of childcare, continue advocating for it, building coalition, forcing the federal government to create a pan-national childcare strategy.
Thank you, Timothy. Now we're going to move into our rebuttal segment of this question, beginning with Staz, and you have 30 seconds.
So yeah, I actually want to agree with Tim completely on the point of jumping the line and why this need to do so. I think the big part is going to come from making sure that $3.4 million is allocated correctly to put into our proper childcare systems. If that is the case and we make sure that all interests are taken in from both faculty, staff, as well as students, then there may not be a need for our students to have to jump the line and for us to have that discussion of whether that is ethical or not.
Thank you, Staz. We're going to go to Timothy for a 30-second rebuttal.
Thanks. I also want to raise the issue of what our provincial government has been doing with childcare. They're refusing to fund childcare, and I, as VP External, will definitely be lobbying the provincial government. For example, recently they cut the minor capital grants by 40%, and what this means for childcare services at UBC is they aren't able to replace the toys, which are plastic, which they know are toxic, with non-toxic wooden toys. This is definitely a huge issue, and it's affecting the safety of our children. So I would definitely be lobbying on that.
Thank you, Timothy. We're going to go to Jeremy now for 30 seconds.
Thanks. Recently, UNICEF did a criteria check of all the developed nations, and Canada consistently ranked last. In fact, Canada failed 9 out of 10 of the surveys that they did on funding for childcare, as well as the availability. So one thing that we definitely have to make sure is at the forefront of this debate is the fact that the government needs to step up. In the OECD, we're ranked last, and that's embarrassing, and we need to make sure the childcare is at the forefront of that.
Thank you, Jeremy. We're going to move into the third question of this debate. With the recent controversy this fall over the UN complaint, how autonomous should the Office of VP External be from Council? We're going to start, the order is going to be Jeremy, Staz, Timothy, and then the rebuttal order will be Staz, Jeremy, Timothy. Beginning with Jeremy. 1 minute.
The External Office is part of the AMS. There's no autonomy there. The nature of the external office is innately political, but it should never be partisan. That's sort of the stance that that council takes. On the occasion that council does take a political view, then it's the responsibility of the external office to take that view forward and to act accordingly. It is not appropriate for the external office to act independently of council, especially if that independent act is simply because they knew that council would not agree with their actions. Over the coming year, we'd like to see sort of an integration of the external office with the general student body and more openness with council, whether that's through open house meetings on external policy, whether it's advertising the University and External Affairs Committee, which is the new committee structure for how we deal with external affairs. But regardless, students need to be part of the process. The external office needs to represent student council, and they cannot act independently.
Thank you, Jeremy. We're going to go to Staz now for 1 minute.
The external office should never be politically charged, and I know it's been said that that's the innate nature of the external office, but realistically, it's student needs and interests and values that need to be at the forefront of the external office as well as the AMS Council. And in order to work with the AMS Council, it's not about the council backing up the external office's actions, but more about the council having trust in the external office and VP External and have the buy-in of the council to make sure that when it comes to a vote, the council has the trust and the faith in the external office to say, listen, these guys have done their due diligence. They're not a political party. They're not associated with one. They're going to be doing all their actions are going to be happening for the best interest of students, which is the most important thing that can come out of the external office. And of course, transparency, student feedback is huge after some of the incidents that have occurred this fall. And, you know, students need to be consulted. It's a basic market research problem. The more students you consult, the better, you know, area of feedback you get, the better results that you're going to get in the end.
Thank you, Staz. Timothy, you have 1 minute.
Thank you. I would absolutely believe that the VP External Office needs to be political. Of course, it should never, ever be partisan as a nonprofit organization, but it needs to be political in order to champion the causes of students. Now, in regards to the tensions between Council and the VP External Office and the autonomy of it, one thing we need to recognize is that the executives are directly elected by students. They are not elected through Council. So there's a democratic tension between that, and I'm really glad that we're starting to address this issue of reform. Now, in regards to a disagreement between AMS Council and the external office last year, the underlying issue here is tuition fees and where AMS Council's policy is on tuition fees. Currently, your AMS Council, your student union, believes that it's okay for tuition fees to increase. I definitely do not believe that. I believe that tuition fees ought to be reduced and government funding needs to be increased.
Thank you, Timothy. That concludes our debate for VP. Sorry, no. We've got 30 seconds for Staz to rebut.
Yeah, so just to rebut a point that Tim just brought up, or a couple of points, in terms of the how politically charged the office should be, I think relationships are built on a personal level. They should never be built on ideology, and students should never be represented based on a political ideology, but rather on a very personal level and on the values and needs of the students, as well as council and external office acting independently. Yes, we are elected, but so is the rest of the council, and the council represents a vast majority of student population as well as the external office itself, so we should be taking that into account when making decisions.
Thank you, Staz. Timothy, you have 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you. I never said that this office is partisan. It never is partisan. But in order to champion the causes of student issues, you need to be political. You need to be able to send a strong message to government. Now, in regards to the elections and how it works, the executives are directly elected by students and hence are directly accountable to students. Council obviously is elected by students as well, and they are also accountable to students. Thanks.
Thank you, Timothy. Jeremy, you have the last 30 seconds of this debate.
Thanks. It's strange that Tim would say that the executives are directly accountable to students when no consultation was done with students. Council represents far more students than show up in the AMS executive election. So to say that that's a mandate to do whatever they want is a complete fallacy. Also, I think that Tim has been trying to misinform the public, saying that council supports tuition increase. No, the current policy states that rising at the cost of inflation, meaning no change in real dollars, is appropriate. And that is not increase in tuition.
Thank you, Jeremy. That concludes the debate for VP External. This is the 2010 AMS elections are on now. Voting began today. Encourage all students to vote online. And I want to thank Timothy, Staz, and Jeremy for coming into the studio for this debate. And unfortunately, Aaron was not in attendance at this debate for VP External. Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey.
Hey there. So, it's been 24 hours. Got my money?
Oh, you know what? Just give me till next Friday. I'll have it for you.
Oh, that's funny. I could have sworn I said have it today.
Yeah, I don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, well, all right then. That's good, OJ.
Ah!
Yeah, that hurt. That hurt.
What the hell?
Yeah, it feels so good.
Thank you to all the donors who pledged their financial support during the CITR on-air fund drive. We are moved by your generosity, and thank you for enabling us to purchase new equipment and improve our programming. Do remember to stop by the station, pay your pledges, and pick up your prizes. We look forward to meeting you anytime between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on weekdays. Thank you again for your amazing response. Listen to our happy voices on the air, happier after we purchase new equipment for our studios. Thanks again.
You got till 5 o'clock, you hear me? You got till 5 o'clock.
You freaking psychopath!
Clean yourself up.
CITR loves its friends. Having a Friends of CITR card entitles you to awesome discounts from businesses in your community. Maybe downtown is your stomping ground. Present your CITR card at 212 Productions Limited, Beat Street Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, Hits Boutique, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Scratch Records, The Fall Tattooing, Flaming Angel Designs, Spank Clothing, Heart and Soul, Pacific Cinematheque, and True Value Vintage, and receive great discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
I wanna love you and treat you right. I wanna love you.
CITR News is committed to providing you with in-depth Olympic coverage from an alternative perspective. As part of this coverage, we are launching a new Eyes on the Street feature, where Vancouverites will have a chance to tell their Olympic story. We want to hear your perspective on life in Vancouver during the Games. That's why we're inviting you to be CITR's Eyes on the Street this February. If you're at an event, a protest, a celebration, or even simply on the bus, tell us about it. There are three ways to file a report. Call our Eyes on the Street hotline at 604-822-5334. Email news at citr.ca or tweet CITR News. Then sit back and wait for your report to be featured on the next edition of News 101, which airs Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. right here on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:54. In studio, we have the two candidates for VP Admin, Ekaterina Dovzhenko and Michael Hack. And they're both aware of the format of this debate and the rules, so we'll jump right into the debate, into the first question. And the first question is as follows. How will you ensure that the sub-renewal will be completed in as timely manner as possible? Michael, you have 1 minute.
Okay, so one of the things with the sub-renewal project is you have to be working with the university, finishing up negotiations. I know current VP Admin Crystal Hahn has been spending a lot of time working with the university, negotiating the finance terms with them. So I think just one of the big issues is to continue working with the university. I know that they have a couple all-day sessions with the university just to finish up the negotiations.
Thank you, Michael. Ekaterina, you have 1 minute.
I agree with Michael with that, but not only working with the university, but working with stakeholders such as the students and with MHPM, which is our sort of consultant when it comes to project management. So definitely being respectful when it happens, when we have negotiations, but also making sure that we are putting our foot down when it comes to negotiating with the university and making sure that it is a student-driven process.
Thank you, Ekaterina. Michael, you have 30 seconds for a rebuttal.
I actually don't have anything to rebut against.
Okay, then we'll...
We pretty much agree with a lot of each other.
Do you have anything you'd like to say for 30 seconds, Ekaterina?
No, thank you.
Okay, so we'll move on to the second question. The AMS is in a structural deficit right now. Should clubs see their funding cut? Ekaterina, we'll begin with you, and you'll have 1 minute.
In terms of actual club funding, most of the time clubs get their funding from membership fees and not so much the AMS. I probably would be against cutting any funding with the clubs, and I'm actually for increasing, sort of reviewing the club's benefit fund and removing those restrictions so students can have student initiative processes within clubs. So to answer that, I would be hesitant to cut funding for clubs.
Thank you, Katerina. Michael, you have 1 minute.
And I'm just going to agree with pretty much what Katerina had said. I do not believe that we should cut funding for the clubs. I believe one of the important referendum items are to increase the AMS fees, and because that's important because every year, everything that the AMS does and the services that it provides are subject to inflation, whereas each group, each different stakeholder group, each club, though their expenses are subject to inflation, so it's definitely important to keep everybody's on budget.
Thank you, Michael. Katerina, you have 30 seconds for a rebuttal.
I have nothing to rebut, but I do have something to add in terms of the fees and the CPI indexing. So the biggest thing is making sure that we know that the sub-renew fund will not be indexed right now. It'll be indexed in a couple years, so making sure we know that as well.
Thank you, Katerina. Michael, you have 30 seconds for a rebuttal or additional comments, if you please.
I actually don't have anything either.
Okay, we'll move on to the third question of this debate. How will you, as VP admin, ensure that the UBC that the UBC administration will genuinely listen to the AMS, and how will you ensure that, as VP admin, you will foster a meaningful and effective working relationship with the UBC administration? We're going to begin with Michael. You have 1 minute to respond to that question.
Okay, so the very first thing we need to be doing in terms of working with the university is to be respectful of the university. We can't really go around saying whatever we please. We have to be respectful. We have to be working with them and not by working against them.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Katerina, you have 1 minute.
I think the biggest thing we need to remember, it's not us versus them. It's not the AMS and students versus this all-evil university. There are times when we have differing priorities, and that is an issue, but it's something that we need to work with them, and we need to work and make it better. In terms of what we can actually do is being respectful, making sure that, in terms of my portfolio, being respectful during negotiations, but also being respectful as a general AMS and making sure that we make sure that whenever we have press releases, we tell them beforehand and so on, and all these different things.
Okay. Thank you, Katerina. Michael, you have 30 seconds for a rebuttal or additional comments.
And I have nothing else to add to that.
Okay. We'll go to Katerina. You have 30 seconds for any additional comments or a rebuttal.
No, I think it's great. Thanks.
Okay, and I guess since this is such a short debate, we can either end it up here or we can each give you an additional 30 seconds to make any closing remarks. We can begin with Katerina.
Okay. So first of all, I just want to thank everyone that has listened. This is a really great idea. This is the first time it's happened. And I want to speak to the importance of voting in general. Just make sure you vote and make sure you vote informed, because great leaders happen when people vote informed. Vote for me if you want, but vote in general.
Thank you, Katerina. Michael, you have 30 seconds.
Perfect. Thank you. I as well want to thank everybody for listening and everybody that has been paying attention to the election. I know one of the issues is it's really hard to keep students engaged, and hopefully people are going to start to get engaged. The sub-renewal project is coming up, and we're going to have to select an architect, and hopefully we're looking to get as much student input with that as possible. Happy elections, everybody.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you to you too, Katerina. We really appreciate you coming in. And this concludes the debate for VP admin in the 2010 AMS elections. Voting is open online. We encourage all students to do so at this time. Thank you, and we're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. We have an interview with the candidate for VP Finance. This is News 101. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey, good morning, Matt and Meredith, and I can tell you already Canada is ready for the spotlight, for their shining moment.
There's a moment in time coming for Canada, and we're all going to be part of it, and it's not going to be something that we so much watch, but we own it. It's ours. But we own it. It's ours. It's ours. It's ours. It's ours.
John Furlong promised that the Olympics would be ours, but time and time again, we've seen that the Games have only taken the city away from us, displacing the homeless, criminalizing poverty, causing vast environmental degradation, and exchanging our civil liberties for the corporate spectacle. See the Olympics in a whole new light at the Rethinking the Olympics Conference, organized by the UBC Social Justice Center and held in the Sub January 26th to 28th. Learn more at panels on Rethinking the Olympics, on the impact on housing, and on the student and activism. Dive in with an interactive workshop on art and activism, a workshop from Food Not Bombs Vancouver, and a Know Your Rights workshop from the BC Civil Liberties Association. Check out The Coca-Cola Case, a film spotlighting the labor policies of the Olympic sponsor, and celebrate with drinks and music at the Grad Student Center Penthouse. Go to www.resistubc.com for more information, or search Rethinking the Olympics Conference under Facebook Events. And keep your eyes open for events on campus January 20th.
It's been so long, we're glad we came before. We got the fame or had a name, a story hasn't changed with accolades, we're still standing and we'll be back again. It's been so long.
Australian hip-hop group The Hilltop Hoods have already dominated Down Under, and now they're looking to do the same here in Canada. Catch The Hilltop Hoods February 10th at Venue in Vancouver.
The tour, in support of their platinum album State of the Art, will be their first headlining tour in Canada. See The Hilltop Hoods up close and personal before they graduate to stadium shows.
Tickets are going fast, so get yours sooner than later. Tickets available now at Ticketmaster, Livestock, and Zulu.
The Hilltop Hoods at Venue in Vancouver, February 10th. Don't miss it.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. In studio, we have the candidate for VP Finance, Ellen Tayar. Thanks for being with us, Ellen.
Yeah, thank you.
So we're going to, I just want to start sort of informal because you're sort of running unopposed. Why are you running for VP Finance?
So I'm running because as the SAC Vice Chair this year, I've seen a lot of inefficiencies in the system, the way it's organized. And I have good ideas on how we can reorganize it and to make it more efficient. The biggest issue this year is a budget deficit, and I think I have good knowledge of the system to make changes to make it more efficient to get rid of our budget deficit.
So the AMS right now is not in a very sound financial position. How do you plan to reduce costs while maintaining student services, and what would you like to see in the next year?
Mm. So, yeah, our budget deficit, the structural deficit, is huge. The easy thing would be to cut a couple services, but obviously that's not the way I want to go. And making changes in the way our organization is structured is the main thing I plan to do. For example, reorganizing the Student Administrative Commission has, the way it's organized right now, is not really working efficiently and fluidly. So reorganizing Finance Commission, the SAC, as well as the services, we need to have an extensive review of the services, especially SafeWalk, because it is a huge drain on our finances.
You mentioned that you don't want to see services cut, though, but if it comes to that point, are there services that you believe will need to be cut? For example, SafeWalk. Not necessarily fully cut, but maybe reduced from their current state.
Yeah, I don't foresee the need to completely cut any services. Reducing is, again, it'll be tough to do, but I think we need to rethink the whole safe walk concept and how it helps us. It might be outdated, so we need to do an extensive review before we make any decisions.
Is there any room for expansion with any services or anything particularly that the AMS should take on?
With our current financial status, I think it's hard to promise any expansion, and it's too optimistic to expect a surplus. So I don't foresee that this year.
Right. Well, before we let you go, are there any closing comments or remarks you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Sure. So I've been working at AMS for the last 9 months, and experience is one thing that I have over a lot of the other candidates, especially my opponents. But most importantly, I think it's a fresh way of thinking and understanding the system that really matters. And I think I can provide that as your VP of Finance.
Thank you for joining us in studio, Ellen.
Thank you.
And that's our program for January 25th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Brad Pepping produced this radio program. For more news, join us this Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst from the entire news team at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for This Side of Monday right here on 101.9 FM, CITR.